And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Mayday. Mayday. It's right around the corner. But this Mayday may be a Mayday for help. The Earth needs help. That's our job, you and me, and probably everyone you know. It's time to do whatever we can to bring peace to the valley. Because the more we look around, the more it seems like there's a war on wonder. Today, we cover two important stories. One of giant big fish, the other of a legendary pack of wolves. Each suffered a great loss, and there's a story for us all in the telling. When we return here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
I want to welcome all of you to another Voice of the Earth broadcast on good old www.wildsidenews.com. It's been well over a year since I began the Wild Side News, and it's been, for me, what I hope it has been for you who listen regularly, and there are now thousands of you, an ongoing education about the state of the mystery. I was thinking about opening the show with a short reading from one of my favorite nature writers, but as there are so many, I paged through a collection of some of the early writers and came to an unsettling conclusion. Namely, the voice of the earth has changed through time. Nature writers of the past wrote of the wonder with a pure voice. Listen. Walt Whitman. Now I see the secret of the making of the best persons. It is to grow in the open air, and to eat and sleep with the earth. John Muir. This grand show is eternal. It is always sunrise somewhere. The dew is never all dried at once. A shower is forever falling. Vapor is ever rising. Eternal sunrise, eternal sunset, eternal dawn and gloaming, on sea and continents and islands, each in its turn, as the round earth rolls. And of spring, Helen Keller wrote, what a joy it is to feel the soft, springy earth under my feet once more, to follow grassy roads that lead to ferny brooks, where I can bathe my fingers in a cataract of rippling notes, or to clamber over a stone wall into green fields that tumble and roll and climb in riotous gladness. And Sigurd Olsen. Beauty is composed of many things and never stands alone. It is part of horizons, blue in the distance, great primeval silences, knowledge of all things of the earth. It is so fragile it can be destroyed by a sound or thought. It may be infinitesimally small or encompass the universe itself. It comes in a swift conception wherever nature has not been disturbed. These voices made up the body of nature writers. But the voices of the earth have changed. For we have changed the earth, and the wonder is under siege. There is a war on wonder, and I, for one, rise each day to stop it, and I invite you to do the same. This last week had two unique stories about the war on wonder. Here in San Diego, a big fish died. Was killed, in fact. A giant black sea bass, known to divers for years as Blackie, in the La Jolla Cove Reserve. It became overnight the pale male of San Diego. People mourn the death of this fish. We tell this story in this first segment of the Wild Side News following the news. And in Alaska, just outside the boundaries of Denali National Park, a shot rang out and killed the alpha male of the legendary Talkeet wolf pack that has been researched for over 50 years. Weeks earlier, his alpha mate was killed in a leg trap just beyond the legal border of the park. And weeks before that, well, we have good reason to believe that that long legacy of wonder is now gone. We go in depth as we talk with Dr. Gordon C. Haber, who has been independently researching this pack for nearly 40 years. No one knows as much about them, has spent as much time with them, has fought so hard to protect them as he. Stay tuned for segments 2 and 3 as we try to understand what this war on wonder is really doing to our world. Each week I try, as best I can, to project a hope and inspire us all to quicken our awareness that the wonder is waning and that we must stand up for the earth. Because if we don't, the killers of wonder will win. Today, a tribute to two great creatures who took the chance to play and dance in peace with us and who now reside as dead trophies in the minds of two small men. Thanks for coming along. But first, the news. Following 2 years of ongoing drought, western states have been warned about the potentials for yet another summer of severe forest fires. Particularly vulnerable are forest areas in southern New Mexico and Arizona, where the drought has been particularly intense. To counter these increased threats, the Interior Department and the U.S. Forest Service have thinned trees and removed brush on 4.2 million acres. Funding for thinning and brush removal has been increased from $811 million to $867 million, focusing much of the efforts at removal of combustibles around populated regions. Hikers, campers, hunters, and everyone else is encouraged to be particularly careful with any potential fire hazards in high fire danger areas this summer. President Bush is speaking up about the environment in an effort to address the root causes of high energy prices that are continuing at record levels. A barrel of oil is now holding at around $55. Bush's recommendations will focus on streamlining the lead-up to the development of more nuclear energy plants, using deserted military bases for locating new oil refineries, providing tax credits for hybrid and fuel cell cars, and the use of clean diesel fuels. The one drawback is that each of these proposals will take years to implement. Meanwhile, the price of gas is ghastly. Just about the time that we hear environment in every newscast, the Office of Management and Budget has withdrawn all funding, namely $14 million earmarked for providing and promoting environmental education programs in the nation's schools. To counter this measure, a group called the Campaign for Environmental Literacy has developed a website at www.fundee.org. www.funde.org. Through this website, the public can send letters to their senators and representatives to encourage them to restore funding the environmental education projects. The effort has the support of such groups as the American Zoo and Aquarium Association, National Wildlife Federation, Audubon, and the World Wildlife Fund. Again, that address is www.fundee.org. My recommendation would be to provide audio cassettes of Walden to every school in America. Contact me if you like that idea. And the Rainforest Action Network has gotten another financial giant to commit to forest sustainable practices as corporate policy. Following last year's adoption of similar standards by Citigroup and Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase is now on board to do the right thing. The comprehensive environmental policy is designed to address global warming and deforestation and recognize the rights of indigenous peoples. J.P. Morgan Chase's new policy includes following guidelines in alliance with the Forest Stewardship Council, which certifies woods as coming exclusively from forest and community-friendly sources. Recognizing the rights of indigenous individuals and communities to self-determination over issues affecting their lands and territories, and encouraging clients to develop carbon mitigation plans to reduce greenhouse gases. J.P. Morgan Chase, welcome to the future. May all of your children and your children's children flourish and learn to buy energy-efficient cars. And a new report by the Environmental California Research and Policy Center maps out a plan for California to achieve its million solar roof goal and phase out the rebate program by the year 2016. Stating that lowered costs of solar power will offset the rebates through the years ahead, the report projects a break-even point in 10 years. Now that's a bright idea for a better world. And a report last night on NBC News says that half of all honeybees in the U.S. are gone, primarily to a small mite that infests beehives and can quickly decimate a colony. Although some may say, good riddance, we must remember that these little workers put food on our tables. Their mystical work, cross-pollinating our crops, trees, fruit, and flowers, that evolved in some unfathomable way, is yet another example of just how complex this little world of ours is. Say a prayer for the honeybees tonight when you go to bed. And that's the news. This week in San Diego, along the luxurious La Jolla Colony Cove, people were stunned to learn that a fish had died. It was, yes, a fish of legend, and yes, a friend to those who dove into the ocean sanctuary where such fish lived in safety. Year after year, divers were met by this fish named Blackie. He was like an underwater neighborhood dog. He swam up to his diver friends and took their pats and panderings. And then the war on wonders struck, suddenly, and Blackie was killed. To many, murdered by a senseless act by an unimaginably unconscious, uncaring, and unforgivable diver who, with one finger, sent a spear straight on through this gentle giant. And now joining us from La Jolla, California, is Rod Watkins, who is the owner of Scuba San Diego. Welcome to the Wild Side News, Rod.
Oh, thank you very much.
You have a scuba service. Tell us about Scuba San Diego.
Well, Scuba San Diego is a diving school and diving guide service in San Diego. And we service over 40 different hotel locations as well as directly off the Internet. People who wish to experience La Jolla Cove Ecological Reserve call us, and we would take them out on guided tours of the kelp forest to look at the different kinds of sea life there. The cove is a really unique resource. It's one of the oldest marine reserves on the West Coast, established in 1929. So it has a really good representation of what a nearshore ecosystem would be like quite some time ago.
You have a particular fascination with this area, the kelp forest. Tell people what you experience and what people might experience when they're in La Jolla Cove and scubaing and skin diving in the kelp forest.
Well, of course, the kelp forest is a unique experience for any diver. It exists, this particular form of kelp, the giant kelp, Macrocystis pyphora, exists only here on the west coast of the United States. And it can grow from depths of 135 feet to the surface. It's actually in the 45-foot range where we would be taking our guests, because it's the nearshore area that has the most abundant sea life in it, and of quite amazing size and age. Some of these animals have been there, like I said, undisturbed for the most part for up to 75 years.
And so it is literally huge. I mean, these are huge plants that you're able to swim amongst.
The kelp, of course, is harvested commercially here by a local company. But in the La Jolla Cove Ecological Reserve, the harvesting of the kelp is not permitted. This has presented a pretty stable hideaway for certain forms of sea life.
And that actually is part of the basis of the story. This week, there was an unfortunate event that happened in the reserve. Some people may say not. There was a mishap. Why don't you tell our listeners what happened?
An individual actually entered the reserve from a powerboat. Powerboats are not permitted inside the reserve itself, but this particular case, they came up to the edge of the reserve and entered the water with a spear gun and scuba equipment, passed into the reserve and speared a giant black sea bass. His scientific name is Stereolepis gigas. And these guys can get up to 500 pounds. I mean, they're majestic fish. And I would equate swimming next to one to being like next to a Volkswagen underwater with fins on it. They're quite gregarious and very amiable. They have no fear of divers at all, and they represent no danger to divers. This individual speared this fish for, I guess, for his home plate. I don't know what he would do with 200 pounds of meat. This was about a 50-year-old fish. And I've been diving with these fish in the cove since 1968 myself. So this was like having one of your best friends murdered.
But now we're talking now about a fish, and a lot of people don't equate fish with a very personal friend, particularly not in the situation where you're out in an open ocean. And yet, that's what you're telling me.
Well, fish, there's some people who are afraid of, actually afraid of fish, and other people just don't like them next to them in the water, and for that reason don't even snorkel. And we've come across people like this over the years in our business. But actually, there's no end to the wonder and the beauty of these animals. And in this particular setting, these fish are so rare that you wouldn't see them. I only know three other places on the West Coast where you could actually count on seeing these fish regularly on a single scuba dive. We can almost guarantee one of our guests that they're going to see one of these fish in La Jolla Cove. In fact, we've had people travel only to see these fish from Los Angeles, from Europe. I mean, we've had people travel to see the kelp forests from all over the world because I suppose the California coastline is renowned for the kelp forests, but not so much for the sea life. I've been diving in these waters for 37 years. I can tell you without a doubt that there's very few places on the coastline where you would ever hope to see one of these fish. And a lot of the other fish in the reserve, in the sizes that we see them, like calico bass, which are prized also by anglers, up to 20 inches and 24 inches are common inside the reserve, where you would never find these fish in that size at the Channel Islands because they've been fished out, so to speak. I can remember my first dive in Anacapa Island in 1968 and diving into what was just the most incredible paradise of life, being surrounded immediately by fully mature sheep's head bass and calico bass, sea lions and abalone all over the bottom. And today, if you went to Anacapa Island, if you were a diver from 1968 and you hadn't been diving in the last 37 years and you went to Anacapa today, you would think the entire planet died. The La Jolla Cove area has been, they've been trying to protect it for, you know, like I said, 75 years. So if somebody was to ask me where I would go in California to have the best sea life experience from the standpoint of fish, I would have to say La Jolla Cove. And if you get even a moderately clear day there, you're going to remember that experience for a long, long time. We have people from all over the world come and dive with us here and say, that was just a brilliant experience, and can't believe the size of that fish.
Here is one sea bass, giant black sea bass, that was unfortunately killed. And it's really creating quite a stir in the community here and in the dive community because, as you say, this fish perhaps was specifically known to the divers.
Oh, you can tell these fish by their markings. There's another old-time diver here who's been free diving out there, and he had a name. I didn't realize it, but he had a name for this fish. He called it Blackie. It was particularly well marked. We've pretty much pinpointed the locations where they hang out most regularly, and that's why I say we can almost guarantee a diver that they're going to see a black sea bass. I had a lady, I took her out personally because she was from some dive club in Los Angeles, and she said she's never seen one. She's been to Catalina numerous times to try and see him at Italian Gardens and never connected. And I said, well, come down here. I said, if you don't see one, you will not have to pay for the dive. She didn't believe me. She saw five of them in one dive.
Wow.
And she was amazed. I've counted 28 on certain dive about two summers ago. And depending on the time of year, they will move from a one spot in the reserve to another spot as a group. In fact, they are members of the grouper family, and groupers are called groupers because they group up.
That's great.
And they kind of hang out, you know. We've been on dives where we've gone with the group of groupers, and they just kind of mill around, and eventually they get bored and swim them off at a distance, and then we'll go away and we'll come back, and they'll be in the same spot again when we come back.
Yeah, are you able to actually sort of establish a relationship? Do they recognize people? Do you get that sense?
They have these parasites on their nose that they carry around with them, and they look like little white hairs on their forehead. And I've gotten familiar with one to the point where he's just about ready to let me pick the parasites out of his forehead like a cleaner fish would. And I've heard of a couple divers who knew Blackie well enough to actually, he would come up to them and they would stroke him and he'd just swim off and then come back. When you're diving regularly out there, you are so happy to see these guys when you come up to them. You feel like, oh, there's my friends again, you know. And they're like having buddies out there in the water column. And it's really tragic because if everybody was as ill-informed as this individual who shot this fish, then there certainly wouldn't be any more of these gentle giants to look at. And it would be sad for my guests and more so for me because I'm there every day and my dive masters are there every day. It would really be sad not to see these creatures in their natural habitat undisturbed. I saw one swallow about a 4-pound lobster whole. I saw one suck about a 20-inch calico bass. I saw a calico bass just disappear in front of my eyes in front of this fish and he hardly even moved. So they're amazing predators, but at the same time, relative to divers, they're curious but non-threatening in any way. I cannot imagine anyone ever feeling threatened by one of these giant fish. Took a student out. She was a little girl. She must have weighed all of 98 pounds. One of the bigger, there's a 300-pounder out there, came right up to us, and this is her fourth dive ever. And got between her and me, and it was the most amazing thing. I looked across to see where Tanya was, and all I saw was fish. And, you know, she was about 5 feet tall. And I was in full scuba gear, and I couldn't see around the fish to see where she was. So when the fish passed by and I saw her again, she was like waving her arms in the air. She couldn't believe it. You know, she was so excited.
That's great.
And when we got out of the water, she said, "Rod, as long as I live, I'm never going to forget this moment on this dive." And I'm thinking, you know, I mean, how can anybody be so completely out of touch with the natural world and completely out of touch with realization that he's entering a protected area and take one of these majestic creatures and kill it for no reason at all? Yeah, I'm still having a hard time getting my mind around what this individual did out there, really. The single most curious thing about these groupers is that they just hang out there, and when we find them, they're apparently doing nothing. They're like a bunch of guys at the bar, you know. And they just seem to hang there together, and I guess they I don't know when they hunt. I've been out there at night, and rarely see them at night grouped up like we see them in the daytime. In fact, I can remember seeing them at night, but only one individual at a time, whereas in the early morning when we go out there, we can see several, usually three, four, and this one occasion and I saw up to 28 of them all just hanging out. Maybe it's like after a tough night of hunting in the dark, maybe they all just hang out during the daytime. In the 20s and 30s, these things were taken off the piers here, like Santa Monica Pier. Oceanside Pier, the pier in front of the Hotel Del Coronado here, which is a pretty famous tourist landmark here in San Diego. Back in the 20s, they were catching them daily, you know, 300, 400, 500 pounders. And they finally wiped them out. The bottom line is, if we don't set aside even more areas as no-take zones, then we're going to guarantee the non-existence of fishing stocks and the non-existence of places like La Jolla Cove to go and actually see these animals in the wild. And without doubt, this fish just ambled up alongside the diver and was hanging there. And he probably fired the spear from less than a foot away from the fish.
Rod, if people wanted to get the chance to see a sea bass, can they contact you?
Online, you can go to scubasandiego.com or just give us a call. We're in the Yellow Pages in San Diego. You can email us off our website. We have pictures, actually, on the website of several different types of fish that frequent the La Jolla Cove Ecological Reserve. And if you're not a diver, you like wild things, you can see one in captivity at Stephen Birch Aquarium, which is associated with the Scripps Institute of Oceanography here in La Jolla, very near La Jolla Cove. So if you don't want to get wet and put a scuba tank on your back, you can check one of these beautiful fish out. So if you're not a diver, I encourage you to come down and take a look at our Stephen Birch Aquarium here.
Well, it's so sad that Blackie has gone, but perhaps his legacy will inspire people to pay a lot more attention, even to big fish.
Obviously, we just don't want his life to go for nothing. And if people can get tuned in to the necessity to enforce our fish and game regulations, and if people who are training divers and people who are going fishing are encouraged to study and understand the regulations and laws related to fishing and spear fishing and commercial fishing, and everybody becomes aware of the absolute necessity to observe those rules, then I think there is hope. We do need to establish more permanent reserve zones in the coastal region, not so much the offshore. The Channel Islands, of course, is obvious. But in coastal California, we need to identify sensitive areas and set those aside as well.
Rod Watkins with Scuba San Diego, I want to thank you for being on the Wild Side News, and I hope we have a chance to talk again. And I encourage people to go and check out Scuba San Diego.
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity to talk about our friend Blackie, who no longer is with us, and he's got some brothers out there, so we're going to try and do our best to spread the word that this is something that people need to pay attention to.
Well, Blackie's legacy just reached around the world, so his spirit lives on.
Okay, thank you very much.
What is the difference between these two divers, the one that thrills and the one that kills? Somewhere in that explanation lies the legacy of this war on wonder. When we continue, we head on up to Alaska, to the great Denali National Park, where the war on wonder struck again. The legendary Talklat wolves may have disappeared forever. When we return, a tribute to a friend on this special Voice of the Earth edition of the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Our news is filled with the stories of the pious, the righteous, the religious, and the right. Most of humanity understands the need to let the sacred express itself in its own mysterious ways. But this week, in Alaska, a sudden act, a shot, and another victim falls to the war on wonder. A wolf is dead. And a howl is heard in the hearts of many who beg for mercy for the gentle beings. The voice rings out here on the Wild Side News when we return to the story of the Talklat wolves. This week, an alpha male was shot when he crossed the invisible boundary of safety. The leader of the legendary Talklat wolf pack, which had carried on the legacy of this great tribe of animals in the sanctuary of Denali National Park, drawn to the sight of his alpha mate, who had died in a trap a few weeks back. For over 50 years, this Talklat pack has been studied, photographed, filmed, and most amazingly, thrilled visitors to the park, who would, when lucky, share a road or a trail with these wolves that chose to share their territory with the two-legged beasts. For nearly 40 years, a dedicated wildlife researcher has followed their lives, from the air, on foot, and in his research. This week may mark the end of his work, for with the death of this, the last alpha wolf, the Talklat wolves may drift apart forever, victims again of this war on wonder. Joining me now from Anchorage, Alaska, is Dr. Gordon Haber, who is an independent wildlife scientist who's been studying wolves and wolf prey systems for 40 years, since 1966, in Alaska. Dr. Haber, welcome to the Wild Side News.
It's good to be here.
Now, your name is in the news quite a bit right now because of some recent events that are really quite shocking to many people who follow wolves and animals and behavior and populations and things happening all over the planet. And this has to do with the wolf population that's associated with the Denali National Park. Give us the news that is so critical right now.
Well, the Toklat family lineage of wolves has been around since I started there in 1966 doing research on them, and actually Adolf Murray, the famous naturalist, was still in Denali when I arrived, and he died a couple years later, but he told me that that was the same group that he had made famous in his classic monograph, The Wolves of Mount McKinley, from his 1939 through 41 studies. He had continued informal observations during the interim, and when I arrived, he said, well, that's just what you're looking at now, it's just later generations. So I know from my own research there, this group goes back 40 years, and based on what he told me, which is certainly reliable, it's probably older than 65 years. So what makes that so unusual is that you can count on one hand in the entire planet wild vertebrate societies that go back anything comparable to that length in time in terms of their age. I believe Jane Goodell has a chimpanzee troop in the Gombe Reserve in Africa that has been around for something comparable to that. I think there's a well-known pot of orcas off the northwest coast of North America, and there may be a pride of lions, if my memory serves me correctly, in Africa that's maybe 20, 30 years that we know of. But this is clearly, if not the oldest known family lineage of any non-human social species in the wild, it sits right up there within the top two or three. And that gives it enormous scientific value. I mean, it gives you an opportunity to learn, a rare opportunity to learn a whole lot about what makes a successful vertebrate society tick. And this group was hit hard here, starting in February, by trapping just outside the boundary, 100, 200 feet outside the boundary of Denali National Park. First of all, the alpha female is trapped, and then another key female is trapped. And to make a long story short, her mate, the breeding male, the alpha male, just kind of turned very erratic in his behavior after that. He kind of left the six young on their own. He abandoned the territory and started moving very erratically in distant areas. And to make a long story short, he got shot himself way outside the park here recently. And there was another female, probably a two-year-old, that he mated with on March 9th. I watched that. That was after his first mate was trapped. They were in the same trapping area, and some things happened, and they got separated. She's been on her own ever since then, too, and currently, as of a couple of days ago, is 25 miles west of the established territory. So all we have left of this famous, extremely valuable group at this point, at least as of 2 days ago, is the six young wolves. Most of them are pups of the year, born in May of 2004. Might be one or two of those that are two-year-olds. They're hard to tell apart right now. And they're on their own, still in a group as of this Sunday, the 24th. And then this one pregnant female who's still 25 miles away, totally on her own. That's all we have left of this formerly extremely cohesive, fascinating, and extremely valuable group.
One of the things that made this particular group so notable was the fact that they had developed, and unfortunately this led perhaps to the demise, they were really quite friendly with people. They weren't really frightened by people and airplanes and buses and things, and therefore many, many, many people had the opportunity to see these wolves up close. They've been probably photographed more than any other wolf pack in the history of the world.
When I talk about this group being around for 40 years, the continuity that has made them so valuable, it's a combination of genetic and social continuity. It's the combination of the two. There's traditions that span generations, for example, in the way they use certain den sites, certain hunting routes, certain travel routes, certain hunting areas, the way they move between different dens in the summer. There's some very specific patterns. Some of their hunting methods themselves have been carried on across generations. So there's a kind of a dual information transfer, both genetic and social, and that's what I mean when I talk about a family lineage. It's not just a genetic continuity, it's the combination. So with that in mind, yes, they have over the years developed a lot of ability to be seen by people easily in the park, but that's primarily a function of their use of dens, specific dens and hunting routes and so forth in the summer that are within the road corridor of Denali National Park, where there's a lot of open terrain. There's this common sort of belief that these are wolves are habituated, and I differ with that view. Virtually every biologist in the business, and even myself up till a few years ago, had that view. And now I believe it's completely wrong. What these wolves do, and what actually wolves do in other areas also, not just these wolves, in other areas of Denali, their natural behavior is more akin to fearlessness, not fearfulness. Wolves don't really fear anything. You see them acting very bold around moose and bears and everything else. There's no particular reason to expect they should be just fearful of people. And you combine that with their high intelligence, which far exceeds anything in the most intelligent dog you've ever known. It's not hard to understand how wolves arrive in the park, and this actually happens from trapping areas, and within days or weeks, not even months, they're behaving the same way and tolerating people the same way as wolves that have been there for years. It's not a slow process like you sort of expect when you normally think of habituation, nor are they fixating on people as you expect in a true habituation process, and there's no food conditioning involved. Their lack of fear of people is really a lot closer to their natural behavior than the fearfulness. That's something they have to learn when they go out into trapping areas, and they learn that. And unfortunately, though, the only opportunity wolves sometimes have when they leave the park and go outside to learn fearfulness from trapping and hunting, they get one chance, and then it's too late. I mean, they run into a hunter trapper, and they're dead.
I would have thought that it was a process of habituation.
I would have thought the same thing, and until a few years ago, there's too much that happened. For example, his alpha male had just showed up. He came from the most heavily trapped area in the state, and within, I don't know, a week or two, he was just as tolerant of people as wolves that had been there for many years.
This concept that it isn't a matter of habituation, that it is in reality just sort of a natural dynamic of their, they're sharing the space with us, and we happen to be there, but that's okay.
there's an awful lot. You know, I used to believe it was habituation too, but there's just been too much happening in recent years with turnovers and some other groups of wolves in the park where new wolves have appeared from some of, and even this alpha male at the that was just killed. When he appeared in the park, he came from one of the most heavily trapped areas in the state, and yet within days or a couple of weeks, certainly not even a month, he was acting just as tolerant, and I know that from my own personal observations of them, as wolves that have been around for years and years.
Well, this is a type of a topic that we could go on literally for days. Some people would say, well, okay, so we've lost some more wolves, but there's plenty of wolves in Alaska, and the fact that this particular pack of wolves is now, or family of wolves, whatever you want to call it, is almost essentially gone. This legacy is over. They'll be replaced. But quite honestly, I think what you're bringing to this is the important message that it goes way beyond just a matter of populations, that it really has to do with these individuals, their family dynamics, this, which is what you've been focusing on for so long. Boy, give us some of your thoughts on that.
Well, you make a good point there, and this view that populations are all that matter and therefore that the loss of Tokwa is no big deal, you know, you may be shocked, or some of your listeners may be shocked to hear that right now is the line of the National Park Service up here in Alaska too. And one of the reasons those wolves weren't protected where they should have been is much because of opposition from the National Park Service as the state. You know, wolf biology is based primarily on two major evolutionary strategies, both of which are pretty uncommon in among vertebrates, pretty rare. Cooperative hunting and cooperative breeding. And this implies all kinds of close interdependencies, interrelationships among family groups, not across populations. So the preeminent functional unit in wolf biology is the family unit. It's not a population. I mean, when the Park Service up in Alaska and the state people, and these are biologists, mind you, that say this, when they over and over again insist that, oh, well, it's no big deal, we still got a good population across the whole 6,000 square miles, that's just utter nonsense, because for one thing, I mean, technically the population of which the Denali wolves are a part stretches hundreds of miles clear to the Arctic Ocean. You could kill every last wolf in Denali, and that population wouldn't still be endangered just in terms of its numerical status. So there would be no point at which these people, including the Park Service, would argue that there's ever any reason to do anything to protect wolves in Denali.
wolf behavior, this concept, the reality of the family nature of wolves is totally fascinating. I think it's one of the reasons that those people who have spent time studying wolves become fascinated with the way in which they get along, because it's not a simple process. It's very complex. Give us an insight into the nature of the wolf family.
Well, there are different versions of wolf families, of course, and even Toklat, this group, one of the values in studying a single group over a long period of time is that you get a chance to see what, you know, how it can change over time. And that's exactly what's happened with Toklat. Early on in my study, this group was afforded very large numbers of caribou. When there were a lot of caribou, this group had a much looser type of social structure. And now, to make a long story short, the prey situation for this group has changed, and they're dependent much more on moose, for example, now, and mountain sheep, which have a much more dependable season-to-season presence. And this is reflected in a much more stable, more cohesive type of social structure. There are still multiple litters in certain years. As recently as 1990, that group had three, maybe even four litters. I found at least three. And just this past year, the established family group had six pups, and out of the clear blue in midsummer, I saw a young female show up, totally unrelated. I knew she was unrelated just because of her color. Had no relationship to this group at all or any neighboring groups. And she just showed up, looked like a yearling, and I never saw the alpha pair assert much dominance over her. Their yearlings and two-year-olds did. But within a few days, she just literally took over and became the primary attendant by far of the six new pups and just watched over them like a hawk. While she was at the den, which of course meant that she was harassed by them often, that there's a penalty to pay when you have to be close to pups at that age. And she hunted for them regularly, brought food back, regurgitated regularly for them. When she first showed up, she was skinny as a rail. Obviously, hadn't eaten very much and was in really lousy looking shape. Within just a couple of weeks, she filled right out and was just doing great. So, there was kind of a two-way gain there. She obviously gained, but then having that kind of a close attendant, unusually close, throughout the summer as she remained and right up until when she was trapped in February with the pups, I mean, they obviously gained, and therefore the group gained genetically and so forth.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's right that it is only the alpha male and female that are successful breeders?
Well, no, it varies all over the place, and in this particular group, that's by no means been the rule of thumb. In some years it is, but there have been about a third of the years where I could make that determination. There's been multiple litters in this particular group up until now. As I say, two litters is fairly common, sometimes three. In one year, I think there was even four.
Now, is that with between the alpha male and other females, or is it different?
Most of the evidence is that it's separate males, but I have seen cases of polygyny, and one in 1990, in 2002 with this same group, where the alpha male at that time in 2001, the well-established alpha male, was killed during some careless radio collaring on the part of a biologist doing work for the Park Service. And a month later, by pure coincidence, this alpha male that was just killed, he showed up. He came from my other study area, 200 miles away. He came from a group that I had been studying over there.
That's amazing.
And he came by way of a sterilization wolf control project the state was implementing at the time, where they were in that particular area. They were going in and just devastating all, ripping up these groups and taking out all the individuals and dumping them off hundreds of miles away and then sterilizing the remaining male and female. And this was one of the wolves that had been dumped off with a sib 300 miles from where he came from in my other study area. And then by pure coincidence, he then came from that location 200 miles to the south and ended up plop right within a mile of the den of this female who had just a month earlier lost her established mate from this radio collaring thing. And she had already been pregnant from him, and so now she had his young. They had just emerged at the den, and this one of her older offspring, this female that was trapped this past February, apparently bonded with this new male and his sib right away, and she literally brought him back to the den. Her mother didn't want anything to do with him, but it was through the repeated efforts of her daughter that he was able to stay, and within a couple of weeks, he just took the group right over and actually started raising the unrelated young just like they were his own. Now, these are the former alpha male's genes. Why would he do that? Well, clearly these pups in the established group was benefiting from his presence because he was obviously helping to enhance the survival of these young pups. Now, where would his gain be? Well, you know, there would, of course, be a good chance that he would end up mating with one of the females the next breeding season in the following March and have his own young. And in wolf society, it turns out yearlings are extremely important to the success of new pups. They typically are the closest attendants of the pups. Pups from earlier years attend the new pups more closely than the parents even do. And so having yearlings around really does enhance the success of your future genes if you're about to mate. And so, of course, the payoff for him, the potential payoff for him, the other end of the, you know, reciprocity deal here would be in increasing the likelihood of propagating his own genes the very next breeding season. Well, that's exactly what happened. He ended up mating with this young female who had brought him back to the den and her mother as well. That female, that's the mother that he ended up mating with along with the daughter, she ended up disassociating voluntarily from the group a few weeks later, which really surprised me. She never left the territory. She stayed within the territory but just didn't associate with the rest of the group anymore and ended up having his young. She went back to the den that she used the first year her and her former mate, and she went back to that den to have this new batch of young, but she had been doing very poorly on her own, and we know from necropsy that she had two pups, but they never survived. By mid-July, I actually watched her die. She starved to death.
So that really talks as well about the complexity of the whole matrix of wolf populations, that she became, in essence, a lone wolf, and that's not necessarily a good thing to be in a population
of
wolves.
and that was proved by the fact she starved a couple of months later. Pair bonds are extremely close in wolf society, every bit as much so in human society, and every bit as variable.
The story of the Talklat wolves continues when we return with your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
For nearly 40 years, Dr. Gordon C. Haber has literally followed in the footsteps of the Talklat wolves, as will be obvious as we continue our special edition of the Wild Side News. This is a special tribute to the memory, or future, we do not know which for now, of the legendary Talklat tribe of wolves here on your Voice of the Earth, the Wild Side News. You have very strong feelings about the intelligence of the wolf, even as it relates to dogs. And help us understand the differences that you feel are important.
You think of the most intelligent, expressive, emotional dog you've ever known, and I'll tell you that it's just nothing but an average wolf. I mean, they're so far head and shoulders in their intelligence above even most intelligent dog, you know, that they're fascinating creatures. In terms of their complex, highly advanced social behavior, social organization, but they're every bit as interesting, or at least comparably interesting, in terms of their individual intelligence. And it goes even further than that. One of the other things, I think the third thing that has impressed me so much over the years about wolves is their unbelievable sensory abilities and physical abilities. Their eyesight is second to none. I remember once watching... Here were a bunch of sheep, white mountain sheep, sound asleep on a white snowy slope where it had just been fresh snow the night before, and these wolves picked them out from 8 miles away on another mountain, could see them, and they went straight to them and chased them, ultimately caught and killed one. But they picked these sheep out. The sheep were sound asleep, not moving a bit from 8 miles away. Their olfactory abilities are unbelievable. I've found over the years in my study that about half of their winter diet by weight comes from animals that are already dead. They're tremendously efficient scavengers. a lot of moose and sheep and things die from cold stress and other things in the wintertime, and the carcasses are frozen like cement, but the wolves find these and they utilize them incredibly, even though they're so hard. But just to give you an example, I remember one striking case of this. I was watching one of my groups of wolves. They were going in one direction, and suddenly they just immediately came to a stop, came to attention, their ears went up, they just obviously detected something, and they immediately turned in a 90-degree direction with the wind now, and immediately started making a beeline 90 degrees off their established line of travel in this new direction. And I wondered, what the hell is going on here? My pilot and I were circling above, watching a couple hundred feet above like we commonly do. What the heck is going on here? And we followed them for another while until they got, I don't know, a few miles away. And immediately at that point, they started digging like crazy through the snow. And they had dug out a crater probably, I don't know, must have been 7, 8, 9 feet deep. And at the bottom of that crater was a moose carcass. They obviously picked that out, buried under 5, 10 feet of snow, with the wind blowing in the wrong direction. I'll never know. But I see them do this kind of thing all the time. It's just unbelievable, their capabilities. You have to see it to believe it. It's just like, it just can't be. One of the other things that really impresses me is their physical abilities. These are the most magnificent physical specimens that you could ever imagine. I mean, especially here in this area in Denali, they're running up and down these 4, 6, 8, 9,000 foot mountains and peaks regularly. I mean, they're commonly up, travel along high ridges all winter long. That's where they are most of the time, in fact. I remember once, it was just a couple of years ago, where we were watching them. They picked up some sheep in the distance on a high ridge, and they started running after them, and they climbed the opposite slope at a run. You know, they got up, I don't know, it's probably close to 6,000 foot high ridge top. They got up that, and the sheep had already run down the other side and were running for the next mountain. But these wolves, as they went up over the top of this ridge, they didn't miss a beat. They never slowed down a bit. And the ridge, now you got a picture, it's a knife ridge, maybe, I don't know, 5 feet wide in the top. They had just run up, this 6,000 foot ridge from the one side, and now the other side was like a 60 to 70 degree pitch. And it was like an avalanche chute. It was hard packed snow, just like ice. The sheep had already gone down that. That's not terribly surprising. Everybody knows how sure-footed they are. But these wolves just literally flew right over, there were three of them in the lead, and they literally flew right over the top of this ridge, and without ever slowing down an iota, they went right over the top, and they went down the opposite side, the downhill side now. And they did this stiff-legged, like they were skiing. And they just literally zipped. They were probably doing 50, 60, 70 miles an hour. They zipped down that several thousand feet to the next, that opposite slope. And then at the bottom, they just kept running.
Talk about their range. I mean, here we are in Denali. You talk about a wolf, for example, that was 200 miles, had moved 200 miles in I don't know what period of time, but they really do cover a lot of turf on a regular basis.
Well, yeah, they have established territories. Toklot's established territory, for example, is about 600 or 700 square miles. Toklot, in the earlier years, their territory was even bigger, was closer to 1,000 square miles. They range within these well-established areas over tremendous areas, and sometimes they'll go 20 miles in a day, but, you know, other times they'll stay in the same area for a few days. Now, the summer half of the year, they have fixed bases, den sites and rendezvous sites from May through the end of September or October. And that's primarily because the young are just too small to travel regularly yet, and so they provision them at fixed sites. But as soon as the young are able to travel regularly, then they just abandon these sites, and the rest of the year they're just moving continuously within their large territories. But now, in addition to that, they have this extremely interesting behavior. I call these extraterritorial forays, where they just, without warning, completely unpredictably, they just suddenly leave their established territories and take off, and they may go a few miles outside the territory, the whole group, and maybe just for a day or two come back, or they may go out for 2 or 3 weeks and go 100 miles away and then come back. Now, these are very different than dispersals. Dispersals, you know, that's pretty routine in wolf society, too, where animals, certain animals, young animals, some of them 2, 3 year olds, just take off and they just never come back. I mean, they go hundreds of miles away, find new mates, and have new, establish new groups. But I'm talking about behavior where the entire group takes off unpredictably and then comes back. So you're right, they move over tremendous areas on a regular basis, and then even more impressively on these occasional, very unpredictable extraterritorial forays. Just 2 days ago, another group, just to the west of Toklot, hell, they went clear across the Alaska Range, and I had a hard time finding them. When I found them, they were clear south of the Alaska Range. That's on the totally opposite side of North America's highest mountain range, and when my pilot and I finally found them, they were coming back from God knows how far. We were able to track them, snow track them back a ways, but they had obviously been on some distant foray for maybe up to a week, and they were coming back over the top of a 6,000 or 7,000 foot high glacier.
You know,
I hope they made it back at least, because there's a lot of crevasses in that glacier. But
you keep talking about being able to find these wolves. Let people know how you're actually doing that. You spend a lot of time in the air.
Now, in the wintertime, it's all by aircraft radio tracking. They have, where they wear radio collars, and there's usually one or two wolves per group that has a radio collar, and you track them with radio telemetry. In the summertime, I continue to fly, you know, at least a few times a month, but most of the work in the summer is on the ground. I go hiking into the den sites on a regular basis every other day or so, and you know, watch their behavior as closely at these dens. Usually at least a couple hundred yards away. I don't want them to know I'm present, because I want them to behave, you know, other than in response to me. I want to observe their natural behavior. That's kind of the routine. A lot of flying year-round, especially in the winter, and an awful lot of ground observation. Toklot has been the main group that I've observed on the ground as well as the air for 40 years, and I don't know what. It's going to be pretty quiet in their established insight this year, I'll tell you.
One of the reasons that these recent developments have been so significant, because you actually have been able to track daily, hourly movements, and that has been such a valuable resource in terms of really understanding their behaviors, and now that's gone.
That's right. That's one of the, if not the most important value, certainly one of them. You know, it's very rare in the annals of sociobiology and behavioral ecology that anybody's been able to follow an established family lineage of any species in the wild for that long and get such a complete record. I don't have a complete record of them, but I got a darn good stream of information for 40 years. You know, I don't know what's going to happen from here on. There was still six young. There's still six young are still around, but all the important information has now been lost. I mean, in terms of traditions of this group, the alpha male carried that in his head, what was left of information that had been transferred socially over the generations. These young ones don't have much of that. I mean, most of the six that are there now, I mean, they were just born last May, and the first time they were even allowed to travel away from this the den site was in September, so they clearly don't have much knowledge of the little intricacies of the territory and some of the specific hunting methods the group had used and all those kinds of things. So that's what I mean when I talk about the Toklot family lineage. It's not just the individuals themselves. It's all that accumulated learned information in the form of traditions and other related behavior that differs even from neighboring groups and the way they specifically are using this 600 or 700 square mile area. That's gone.
The question that raises from my perspective, which I find fascinating, is obviously, you know, when you take a wolf that has 6 or 7 years worth of life and experience and traveling around, they have a terrific, it must be like a map in their head of sites and places, and they somehow impart that through their experience to their progeny. And that becomes lost when that alpha male and alpha female in this particular case are gone. All that knowledge about that place is no longer available to those young.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, they learn it by following these individuals, and of course they're not around to follow anymore. I mean, ultimately these young would have learned most of those little nuances themselves just by watching and following. It's not taught deliberately. Well, most of it isn't. I've seen some examples of teaching, but usually it's just a matter of the young just watching and following and learning. You're right. First it was the alpha female. She had been around since 1998 when she was born. This new male, as I said, showed up in 2001, so he'd been there for 4 years, and just being with her all that time, I mean, I was confident, I'm satisfied from having watched him in detail, that he pretty well knew the area, knew all these little, or at least most of the little nuances, you know, spatial traditions and some of the other traditions. But there's just no way that other than by just pure coincidence that the young that are there now are going to pick up most of this. I mean, they'll pick up some of the highlights, all right, but most of the really refined things, that's all gone. And that's the biggest tragedy of all here. And, you know, even the National Park Service itself just poo-poos all of that. Says, well, we still got wolves around. Oh, they'll learn what they have to survive and all that. Well, sure.
It's sort of like sending someone out on a journey without a map.
Well, and it's also just part of the natural scheme of things there in the park. It's not a question of how successful their journey will be. Sure, they'll find other ways to make that journey and survive. And that's the Park Service's argument now. My argument is that There's different ways to make the journey, but only one of them was natural, and that was what was going on until we completely changed it all with a major set of human action. But what's so important is the natural, I emphasize the word natural, underlying interplay of events and changes has now been completely substituted with a bunch of human-caused things. But you've really changed the whole set of underlying ecological relationships and important things like traditions, so that, and you know, in a sense, when your concern is only for how many animals will be left, that's kind of the thing that you should be worrying about if you're a zookeeper, if your interest is in maintaining a nice zoo. But if you're managing a national park, it should be just the opposite. It should be that those more basic things, those more refined things, including things like traditions and whatnot, which are clearly lost now.
What I think is important, and I would appreciate your perspective on this, is what really did happen. I mean, these wolves were killed. They were killed,
sure.
some through hunting, some through trapping. What is the value,
sure,
in these animals? Are we supposed to just throw all of this away for the sake of I don't know what?
The most important wintering area to the Denali Park ecosystem is primarily outside that Northeast Park boundary. It's a traditional caribou wintering area, and it's unique because it has some unusual wind patterns that result in less snow accumulating there. And so it serves as kind of a magnet to caribou from the area, and also moose in really deep snow winters because it's easier foraging with less snow. So in a lot of winters, you get a higher concentration of caribou and sometimes moose in that area. And so that, in turn, serves as a magnet to wolves from surrounding areas. As I say, they leave their established territory sometimes, and this is one of them. And of course, the established territory of a couple of these eastern groups just barely goes into that unprotected area. And right now, the protected area bisects the traditional wintering area. So, you know, I mean, the wolves and caribou and everything, they don't know where that line is. It's just an imaginary map line, and they just keep going right across it. But all the trappers know where it is, and hunters, and they line up literally in the winter and nail these wolves when they come across. And it's not just the wolves that we're talking about. It's about half the groups of wolves in the park. Some of them come from 60, 70, 80 miles away for varying periods each winter to hunt in that area. So they're getting hit, and we have not succeeded, unfortunately, in getting the full protection we need there, just as a buffer zone where nothing else would be affected except wolf hunting and trapping. I've been in the forefront of trying to get that area protected, and the biggest opposition, or at least as much opposition to that, has come from the National Park Service here in Denali as anybody from the state, and partly for political reasons. You know, the Park Service likes to get along with the locals, most of whom don't like wolves, and you don't want to be seen if you're a wolf lover if you work for the Park Service up here. And then there's just a lot of bad science behind it, too.
Why do you think that wolves engender such split feelings?
There are a lot of reasons for that, but you know, one of the main ones is there's a lot of, as far as I'm concerned in this business, there's a lot of scientific backwardness. And if you really want to know what I think, and this view, incidentally, about populations that we talked about earlier, and a lot of biologists think populations are all that you got to worry about, you don't have to worry about these individual groups. Well, when you hold that view, of course, then you don't worry about things like protecting a group of wolves like Toklat. That even though they're correct that there's usually about 35 to 40% annual turnover in most wolf populations due to dispersal as well as death, it's a much different kind of distribution of the deaths than in human hunting and trapping and wolf control. In the natural circumstance, typically in a well-established group of wolves, the wolves that are lost each year to death and dispersal come from primarily from the low-ranking end, the younger end of the group. Whereas, as was clearly demonstrated here just the last few months, I mean, it's human impacts, and especially aerial hunting and wolf control operations, but also ground trapping, as we just found out here, can easily take out a lot more of the high-ranking key individuals, a lot more of them at one time than would ever be lost under any reasonable natural scenario that anybody could imagine. And that makes all the difference in the world. And so what I concluded is that when it's human-caused killing, you know, human-caused deaths, because the deaths are distributed much more so among these key individuals, that you can start to see major changes, social changes and other kinds of changes in a group of wolves or a population, even though the numbers might remain about the same. And there are obviously a lot of biologists around who disagree with me, so folks, if you're there listening, let's see you rebut what I said there, and then I'll follow up with a reply to that, and we'll see where it all ends up. There is a more basic reason, perhaps, why people have always had problems with wolves, and or think they do anyhow. And that may go back way into our early evolution. At one time, I'm sure wolves are probably significant competitors and or predators predators on humans before we had very good weapons. And, you know, it was probably pretty adaptive for a long portion of our early evolutionary history to fear wolves. But that's, you know, not clearly the case anymore, and I suppose it still resides in our genes somewhere, some inclination in that direction.
Some theories would suggest that humans and wolves have forged this alliance because we, in many respects, we communicate so directly in the same way. We make eye contact, our body language is very similar in a lot of cases. We're verbal and nonverbal at the same time, and also that wolves, with you talked about their extraordinary capacities to hear and to sense, that the humans actually used them because they were such incredible warning systems about potential dangers.
You make another good point here, and that is that there are some similarities, can be some similarities in the way different, entirely different species find solutions to the same basic ecological problems. And, you know, there are many people, and scientists, and I'm, or at least some scientists, and I'm one of them, who think that wolves probably provide a pretty good model for what early human social systems look like, you know, relatively small, slow predators that are forced with the need to subsist largely on much physically superior prey animals. And the solution to that is to outwit these prey animals with sophisticated cooperative hunting techniques, which, of course, requires sophisticated social organization. One of the best examples I can think of is between wolves and wild hunting dogs in Africa, completely different species. But yet, they both kind of are relatively small, slow predators and faced, again, with the problem of subsisting largely on physically superior prey. And they do that. They overcome that obstacle with very sophisticated social organization. In fact, it's unbelievable how similar, right to the last details, social organization of wild hunting dogs in Africa is with the social organization of wolves, at least the ones I'm studying.
You know, the Tonklat pack has had threats before to their survival, but they've managed somehow always to come through. I've heard in the past they've gotten down to as few as two members. But quite honestly, do you feel that this is the end of the Tonklat?
Well, that was, I was there watching it all when that happened, and the guy was studying them then, too. And I can tell you, it's all the difference in the world between then and now is what happened then and what happened now. And there was a complete reproductive failure, the only one I've ever recorded in that group, no pups at all produced, due to the loss of the second ranking pair. As of spring 98, there were two left in that group, a male and a female. Young adult male and young adult female, and then they regenerated the group. Now this situation here, the only wolves left in the territory right now are just six animals, most of them, except for maybe one or two, are pups that were born in May of this past year. Here now we got six young that are just suddenly bang like that by themselves without the benefit of any of that past accumulated information. It's a very different situation.
Now of the six that are remaining, are any of them collared?
No.
So to a large extent, you've really lost your connection with this.
Well, and it would have be important to have that just to see what the heck happens to them. But the Park Service refused to collar them. They were going to put a collar on that small group of pups, and then suddenly I think they just thought to themselves, well, do we want to have this information about things that are going to happen to them? Do we want that all over the place? Do we want to listen to this for another indefinite period? It'd be easier not to. They're unexplained decision, just all of a sudden not to do it.
We haven't just lost another, or an alpha male and an alpha female. We've lost a lot more. Tell us what that is that we've really lost at this point now, since they're gone.
Well, we've lost, as I've been saying all along, just an incredible scientific opportunity to learn something more about the characteristics of, a lot more about the characteristics of a successful vertebrate society. And we've lost, a group that has provided just unbelievable viewing opportunities and photographing opportunities for visitors to Denali National Park. Maybe more than that, we've lost something that, the kind of thing that really I think is what makes the Earth such an interesting place to be on. I mean, anytime you've got any kind of creature or group of creatures that have been around so long and represent so much history, you know, just thinking about what they've stored away or what they've accumulated and the knowledge they have and all that kind of thing, to me, enriches my environment when I know there's those kind of things running around. I had the same feeling years ago here in Alaska when I read that a bowhead whale had been killed by native subsistence hunters off the northwest coast of Alaska in their, you know, power boats and radio communication and all the rest. It turned out that whale was 150 years old. It was aged, I guess, and thought to myself, well, I understand, you know, why the natives are hunting them and all that stuff, but my God, look what we've deprived ourselves of. I mean, just knowing there's a creature out there that has 150 years of history and stored away and gone through that much history, to me at least, it greatly enriches the planet knowing there's those kind of things around, and it's just hard for me to swallow watching something or hearing about something like that, or in the case of Toklat, watching something like that getting blown away for, oh, I suppose there are good reasons in some people's minds to do it, but to me they're pretty superficial and frivolous.
Well, you're a scientist who is prepared to talk about the sense of wonder. I think that is what is distinguishing your passion for this pack of wolves. How can we help that scientific community embrace and feel comfortable with talking about the sense of wonder?
To me, that's the most important prerequisite for being a good scientist, is having that sense of wonder. And it just, you don't see it much in that many people in this business anymore, and I'm sad about that, frankly. It's missing. And the way most of the biologists that I know up here do their wolf observations, they're pretty much quickie little locations from pretty high up in the air, virtually no groundwork, and it's not surprising they don't appreciate these things. But how any good scientist could not be just literally enthralled? I avail myself of the modern technologies too, aircraft and radio telemetry, but I also get out on the ground a hell of a lot, and that's where you really get the feel for them. Or even when you're in the air, stay around and watch them circling for an hour or more straight like I commonly do. You don't get that from a 5-minute or 3-minute quickie little location, go on to the next one and, you know, recording your data sheet just where they were and go on. So that's really missing, and it's too bad because that's the most important ingredient of all. Without that sense of wonder that just seems to be rare now, I'm just pessimistic about where we're going, and that's maybe the key thing that's underlying the way wolves are being treated in Alaska now. They're treated like vermin. There's about 1,500 a year that are killed every imaginable way here in Alaska. And there's formal aerial wolf control going on now over an area the size of Maine in Alaska, if you add up all the areas. And that's all coming from biologists. It originates with biologists in the field. That's where these wolf control programs are coming from. It's not coming from politicians or political pressure from on top, filtering down to these guys in the field that are therefore being forced to do things they don't want to do. It's not that way at all. That's the common wisdom, but I know because I'm out there and I rub shoulders with these guys. It's just the opposite.
Totally agree with you. It happens in, quote unquote, the environmental community, where you go to an event and if you start talking a little bit too much about the spirit of the animal, the sense of beauty, there's going to be some within that group who look at you as if you're weird, as if there's something kind of strange. For those of us who get it and have that connection with animals and feel that, it's as real as anything. It's part of, as a scientist, I feel it, I know it, I sense it. I somehow we need to bring that into the sciences.
Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of good scientists in this business, certainly in the lower 48, a lot of good wildlife scientists. But here in Alaska, I'm sorry to say, at least the people that deal with wolves and wolf ungulate systems, I am not impressed. And I'm not bashful about saying so, and I've made my feelings pretty clear to the individuals that are in the business up here, and it's only because I'm watching them destroy something that I love and that I think is very valuable to the world. It's not that I'm just choosing arbitrarily to give them a hard time. It's just that I'm watching people doing things here over and over again, making the same stupid mistakes and doing the same things over and over again that are destroying some things that I love and that others, I think, a lot of other people love. And if we're ever going to change that, I feel I have an obligation to try to point out where the problem is originating. I have been convinced for a long time, based on being out there right in the middle of it all, that it's coming from biologists in the field, just like most people assume the National Park Service is representing their interests with wolves in Denali. I'm sorry, in Alaska, that is not the case. The Park Service is doing a great job in the lower 48, in places like Yellowstone, where they got the highest quality kinds of things, management and research going on you can imagine, but it is not the case up here, and that's just very, very sad, and people have to understand that. That's the only way it's ever going to change.
If people want to learn more about what you're doing and actually from this point on follow what happens in this emerging story, what's a good way for them to do so?
My funding comes from an organization back east called Friends of Animals. Of all the people that I know of and all the organizations that I know of that are trying to do something about lousy situation wolves are facing up here in Alaska, there's no organization that is doing more than Friends of Animals, and particularly the president, Priscilla Farrell. She's actually just wonderful.
That website, by the way, is friendsofanimals.org. And you can easily go there, and they have links to this story and others. Well, Dr. Haber, I want to thank you for adding your voice to the Wild Side News. I hope we have a chance to talk again.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
From honeybees to wolves, giant black bass to whales, the war on wonder continues. We must speak up. We must stand up and reclaim our right to celebrate in the Church of the Wood and the Wave and the Wind and the Wonder. For few can deny, these are the greatest gifts the universe has yet to know. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet next time here on the Wild Side News.